McDonald didn't come to a dead end. Whatever radar Clark possessed told him that it was okay to sprint into the dark. That's when he was most dangerous. It was also when he was at his best. Anyway, it took some months before I realized that I was never going to hear about his past from him, at least not in the usual way that information changes hands. The few times I asked him directly how he had got from there to here, which it was becoming clearer was the same as asking how the modern world had got from there to here, he would offer some perfunctory reply and wave me away. "That's boring," he'd say. When I pressed, he might say, "That's the past. I really don't give a shit about the past." Then one day I discovered the cardboard boxes. They were stacked up in a closet in the guest bedroom of his house. It was, like most guest rooms, one of those rooms that looked as if it had been cleaned 1,000 times and never inhabited. Since he first started out in Silicon Valley back in 1979, Clark had the same secretary, a woman named Deanne Schnerning. After Netscape went public in August 1995, she made so much money from her stock in various Clark-inspired enterprises that she bought herself a long gold Cadillac and retired. Up till then, bless her heart, she squirreled away Clark's notes and papers and stuffed them into cardboard boxes. She kept the boxes at Netscape until the company outgrew its space, at which point she had them shipped to Clark's home. The boxes had never been opened. They looked as new as everything else in the room. Clark had no idea what was in them.
"It must just be some boring old stuff," he said.
But he did not mind if I opened them. At the top of the first box there was a yellowing clipping from the local newspaper in Plainview, Texas, where Clark grew up. The paper wanted to let the town know that one of their own had gone to California and created a big company called Silicon Graphics. They played it as a straightforward local boy makes good story and made light of Clark's boyhood failure. They mentioned that he'd been expelled from the local public high school in his junior year. He'd been an indifferent student and a cut-up, one of those great bad examples to youth who prove that if you really want to be a success in American life, you have to start by offending your elders. The offense that got Clark tossed out for good was telling an English teacher to go to hell. Before that, he had exploded a small bomb on a school bus, smuggled a skunk inside a horn case into a school dance, and set off a string of firecrackers inside another student's locker, among other tricks. Once he left school, or school left him, he fled town. The next clue folded neatly inside the cardboard boxes was a photograph of Clark circa 1970, having just received his master's in physics from the University of New Orleans on his way to a Ph.D. program at the University of Utah. He wore thick, dark-rimmed glasses, a crew cut, and an expression that approached but did not quite achieve innocence. In under 8 years, this person, considered unfit to graduate from public high school in Plainview, Texas, had landed himself a Ph.D. in computer science. Actually, the story was more remarkable than that. His father abandoned the family when Clark was a small child. His mother should have taken welfare, but it never occurred to her. The home Clark went back to after a day of turning his school on its head was situated somewhere below the poverty line. When I asked him about the article in the Plainview paper, all he said was,
"I grew up in black and white. I thought the whole world was shit, and I was sitting in the middle of it."
At the minimum age of 17 and a half, Clark asked his mother to sign the piece of paper that permitted him to join the Navy. In September 1961, when the rest of his high school class returned for its senior year, he left Plainview for basic training just outside of New Orleans. His career in the Navy started as badly as his career in high school ended. When he arrived at training camp, he was given, along with every other new recruit, a multiple-choice aptitude test. He had never seen a multiple-choice test, and he didn't know how to take one. To most of the questions, several different answers struck him as at least partially correct. Instead of picking the one that seemed most correct, he just circled them all. The Navy assumed that he knew that circling more than one answer fooled the computer that graded the tests. They charged him with cheating, took him off the ordinary slow track for enlisted men, and put him on an even slower one for juvenile delinquents. Thus, the first time Jim Clark ever heard of computers was when he was accused of trying to fool one into thinking he was smarter than he was. The other recruits who took the multiple-choice test went into a classroom and obtained their high school equivalency diplomas. Clark alone found himself shipped out to sea. There, he spent the next 9 months performing the most disgusting chores that need doing on a ship. Those 9 months at sea have filled a lot of Clark's memory. He recalls officers telling him that he was stupid and bullies tossing plates full of food on the floor just so that he would have to clean them up.
He returned to the Navy's classroom, convinced that Plainview, Texas, just might not be the world's capital of shit. He took his first math test and scored the highest grade in the class. He was unaware that he had any particular aptitude for math and didn't quite believe the result. Neither did anyone else. The Navy gave him another test. Same result. 6 weeks later, Clark was assigned to teach basic algebra to incoming recruits. A few weeks after that, one of the instructors told him that it had been a long time since he'd seen someone so naturally gifted in mathematics. He suggested that Clark enroll in night classes at Tulane University, with a view to getting a college degree after he'd finished his tour of duty. Within 8 years, Clark had his college degree, plus a master's in physics, plus a Ph.D. in computer science. In the Navy, Clark said, he'd learned that his desire for revenge could lead to success. He'd been propelled in the classroom by his anger about the humiliation he'd suffered at sea. Thus, success, for him, became a form of revenge. I returned to the cardboard boxes. They suggested a turbulent early career. There were hints that between 1970 and 1978, Clark had married at least twice, sired at least 2 children, moved back and forth across the country at least 3 times, and had held at least 4 different jobs, mainly at universities. He'd done postgraduate work at the University of Utah with the forefather of computer graphics, Ivan Sutherland. In 1978, he was fired for insubordination from a post at the New York Institute of Technology, at which point a wife, not his first, left him. "I remember her saying that she couldn't live the way I lived anymore," he recalled when asked. "She just wanted a more settled life." When he said this, he was standing outside of his house near his hill. Just a few years back, before the Internet boom, Clark's house in Atherton had been surrounded by empty fields. Now he was surrounded by new houses, many of them bigger than his own. One morning he looked up from his kitchen table and saw the neighbors looking back. He requested, and was denied, a permit to build a fence tall enough to screen them from his view. The city of Atherton, California, had strict rules about fences, and the fence Clark wanted to build was declared too high. So Clark built a hill and put the fence on top of the hill. It did not occur to him that there was anything unusual about this. As he stood beneath his self-made hill, he tried to explain this extraordinary leap in his career from 38-year-old unsuccessful college professor with a warning label on his forehead to a founder of a multi-billion-dollar corporation.
"It was one of those times when the whole fucking world went berserk," he said. "After my wife left, I went into this spiral. 6 months of counseling. Then I said, fuck counseling, it wasn't helping anything. There was all of this self-actualization stuff around EST and that kind of thing. I thought, I don't need some guru to tell me how to find my way out."
"So it was as simple as that?" He laughed.
"Nope, for a year and a half I was in this kind of downbeat funk. Dark, dark, dark."
I said he still hadn't answered the original question.
"It's funny," he said. "One day I was sitting at home, and I remember having the conscious thought, you can dig this hole as deep as you want to dig it. I remember thinking, my God, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in this fucking hole. You reach these points in life when you say, fuck, I've reached some sort of dead end here. What was the point of getting here? And you descend into this chaos. All those years you thought you were achieving something, and you achieved nothing. I was 38 years old. I'd just been fired. My second wife had just left me. I had somehow fucked up. I developed this maniacal passion for wanting to achieve something." He paused. "I guess it was a little bit of self-imposed psychology."
In something like an instant, the man had changed his life. He reinvented his relationship to the world around him in a way that is considered normal only in California. No one who had been in his life to that point would be in it 10 years later. His wife, his friends, his colleagues, even his casual acquaintances. They'd all be new. The result of his self-imposed psychology surprised even Clark. He insists the transformation occurred overnight and that he cannot really explain it, but all of a sudden, the best graduate students at Stanford wanted to work with him on his special project, a computer chip he'd been tinkering with for nearly 7 years. Computer science became a formal academic discipline only in the late 1960s when an obscure subdivision of the U.S. government called ARPA, ARPA, for Advanced Research Projects Agency, funded 4 university departments, at the University of Utah, the Carnegie Mellon Institute, the University of California at Berkeley, and Stanford University.
The best computer science students at Stanford were some of the best computer science students anywhere. Under Clark, they gathered together into a new potent force. The difference was phenomenal for me. I don't know how many people around me noticed, but my God, I noticed. The first manifestation was when all of these people started coming up and wanting to be part of my project. That project turned out to be Clark's first experience with the new thing. It was 1979. Silicon Valley was chiefly a place where chips were made, though this new company called Apple Computer was having some success mass-marketing computers. Clark set to work turning his new interest in being alive into new technology. With his graduate students, he created a chip that could do things no other computer chip could do. That much I knew from a fascinating new book called Dealers in Lightning, about the role of Xerox's Palo Alto Research Center, PARC, or PARC, in the modern computer industry. That day I showed Clark this passage from a chapter called The Silicon Revolution. Years later, Lynn Conway, a PARC researcher, could still remember the moment she first laid eyes on the chip that launched a new science. It was a week or two after Christmas 1979. She was seated before her second-floor window at PARC, which looked down on a lovely expanse of valley in its coat of lush winter green, sloping down toward Page Mill Road just out of view to the south. But her eyes were fixed on a wafer of silicon that had just come back from a commercial fabrication shop. There were dozens of chip designs on the wafer, mostly student efforts from a course being taught with PARC's technical help. They all strived toward an intricate machined elegance, comprising as they did tens of thousands of microscopic transistors packed into rectangular spaces the size of a cuticle, all arranged on a wafer that could fit comfortably in the palm of one's hand. A few years earlier, the same computing power could not have fit on an acre of real estate. One design stood out, and not only because it bore along its edge the assertive hand-etched legend, Geometry Engine Copyright 1979, James Clark. Where the others looked to be simple arrays of devices that formed simple digital clocks and arithmetic search engines and the like, Clark's was obviously something more, larger, deeper, more complex than the others, even when viewed with the naked eye. After the appearance of Clark's chip, the art and essence of computer graphics would never be the same. The computer-aided design of cars and aircraft, the virtual reality toys and games of the modern Midway, the lumbering dinosaurs of the movie Jurassic Park, they all sprang from the tiny chip Lynn Conway held in her hand. Once again, Clark's mind wandered out of the conversation. He had no interest in his geometry engine. He'd never heard of the book or its author, though he did vaguely recall Lynn Conway.
"Kind of overblown title, isn't it? Dealers in Lightning," he snorted, and then moved back to finding something in his house that needed to be changed.
His ego was far too big for garden variety immodesty, taking pride in his past accomplishment. He was actually irritated that he was somehow obliged to exhibit pride in something he had done, and he reacted by looking for something he might do. He'd pulled out the previous owner's idea of ironwork and put up his own. He dug up his swimming pool and moved it across his yard, twice. Now he cast around with the blank expression that always preceded a new plan. I left him to it and returned once again to the room that had been cleaned 1,000 times and cardboard boxes that had never been opened. They went silent. Right up until 1991 was a giant black hole, but after that the paper came fast and thick. First, there was a big bill to Clark from a local hospital. "Motorcycle accident," read a scrap of paper attached to it. A note described an interior tibia detached completely from bone. Beneath the hospital bill and the clinical description of Clark's shattered leg was a rough draft of a paper written by Clark and dated just after his motorcycle accident. His paper was called The Telecomputer.
Chapter 4. Disorganization Man.
In 1956, a Fortune magazine writer named William H. White published his classic study of American corporate life, The Organization Man. The book found its way onto the shelf crammed with evocative 1950s titles, such as The Lonely Crowd and The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. All these texts tried in one way or another to explain the strange uniformity of the American businessman. He commuted to work in his immaculate gray suit from his neat suburban tract house. He kept his front lawn and his hair trimmed to lengths tacitly agreed upon by his peers. He avoided high culture or anything else that smacked of elitism. He worked for some enormous gray corporation such as IBM or AT&T that was more of a home to him than his house in the suburbs. The enormous gray corporation maintained a constant lookout for anarchists trying to pass themselves off as conformists. They devised clever multiple-choice personality tests, such as this, which they gave to anyone who applied for a job. Underline the word you think goes best with the first word. Night. Dark, sleep, moon, morbid. Naked. Nude, body, art, evil. That question came from a test White dug out of the archives of one of the enormous gray corporations. An actual human being read these tests, presumably looking for the fellow stupid enough to circle morbid and evil. When the true organization man read naked, he underlined nude, even if he thought evil. In any case, the organization man's taste for conformity led White to a simple theory. The Protestant ethic, with its emphasis on rugged individualism, had been displaced in American life by something else. The social ethic is the fancy name White gave that something else. The organization man believed in the essential rightness of large groups and the essential wrongness of the individual. He felt very strongly that people had a moral obligation to fit in. To White, this represented an important and possibly permanent shift in American values, a kind of loss of innocence. Americans were not merely working differently than they had in the past. They were voting, praying, dressing, buying, and loving differently, too. And all of it flowed from changes in the corporate culture. When Americans changed the way they made money, they changed a lot of other things, too. The character at the center of White's wonderful psychodrama was the well-rounded man. The well-rounded man was the ideal 1950s type. White wrote his book in part as an argument against the well-rounded man. He believed that when society exalted the well-rounded, it punished the truly talented, the scientists, the artists, the musicians, the engineers, the people who came at life from surprising new directions. The pressure exerted on the oddballs to be normal caused extraordinary products of the human imagination to be discouraged and suppressed. He noted that, searching for their own image, management men look for the well-rounded scientists. They don't expect them to be quite as well-rounded as junior executive trainees. They generally note that scientists are different. They do it, however, in a patronizing way that implies that the difference is nothing that a good indoctrination program won't fix up. Customarily, whenever the word brilliant is used, it either precedes the word but, as in, we are all for brilliance, but, or is coupled with such words as erratic, eccentric, introvert, screwball, etc. Somewhere along the line, the organization man passed from the American scene. Whether he was murdered or died of natural causes is hard to say. Obviously, he had a lot of bad luck between the late 1950s and the late 1990s. One piece of bad luck was rapid technical change, which was a weapon that oddball upstarts could use against the enormous gray corporations. Another was Jim Clark, or more generally, the engineer with a taste for anarchy, who lifted one big middle finger in the direction of the enormous gray corporation. Silicon Valley hatched a lot of certifiable weirdos interested in getting their hands on money and power. These people became some of the most admired businessmen on earth, and yet, by the standards of the organization man, they were barely socialized. Clark's quixotic bid for power and money began at Silicon Graphics. The company he founded with several of his Stanford graduate students was one of a handful that extended the reach of the computer and caused important people to rethink what the machine might be capable of. The chip Clark had designed, the Geometry Engine, was better able than any before it to process three-dimensional graphics in real time and so create a simulation of reality on the computer screen.
Jim's logic was that the world was three-dimensional, and so the computer world would have to be, too, said Kurt Akeley, one of Clark's students. He thought the right way to interact with the machines is the way you interact with the world.
Clark had long been fascinated by virtual reality. The Geometry Engine made it possible to draw and redraw the real world inside a computer, which was the equivalent of bestowing upon the computer a sense of sight. When you turned on the computer in Clark's Stanford lab, you now saw a realistic three-dimensional picture.
Computer graphics is as fundamental to computers as vision is to humans, Clark wrote back in his teaching days.
That thought, strange at the time, soon became commonplace. A lot of people who should have seen the importance of Clark's Geometry Engine thought it was a useless toy. Half the venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road who made their money, in theory at least, financing the future, had failed to see its potential. So had the enormous gray corporations of the late 1970s. Clark had offered to license his invention to IBM, Apollo, Hewlett-Packard, and DEC. All turned him down. Even people whose work would be transformed by his invention were slow to grasp its importance. For instance, an engineer from Lockheed visited Silicon Graphics, SGI, soon after the company was founded. The SGI engineers offered him a demonstration, an automobile depicted and manipulated in three-dimensional space on an SGI computer. "That might be good for designing cars," said the man from Lockheed, "but I design airplanes." He essentially did not believe what he had just seen. He assumed Clark and his engineers had made a one-off trick of putting a picture of an automobile inside the computer. He didn't understand that Clark's new company had made it possible to design everything inside a computer, and that every new Lockheed airplane from now until eternity would be created by Silicon Graphics' technology. The Hollywood people were shrewder about the possibilities, and it wasn't long before Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were banging on Clark's door and asking to be his first customers. The Silicon Graphics workstation made possible a lot of new special effects. The spectacles that overran movies and television in the 1980s and 1990s and kept viewers glued to bad stories were all accomplished with SGI's technology. When a moviegoer rubbed his eyes and said, "What'll they think of next?" it was usually because SGI had upgraded their machines. Someone once said that the best technology is indistinguishable from magic. Clark now had the best magic act in Silicon Valley. The best magic act attracted many of the best engineers. In the Valley, it often did. The Valley had given engineers a place they could make their living outside the enormous gray corporations that expected them to conform. It tended to attract the technologists who valued their freedom and wanted to live out on the edge. In any case, for a certain kind of engineer, the chance to play with hot new technology offsets the career risk of doing so. Clark gave them that chance. In the early 1980s, the labs that housed the world's finest technical talent, Hewlett-Packard, Bell Labs, Xerox PARC, Stanford, MIT, surrendered some of their best minds to Clark's new company. They came from all over, but they came for the same simple reason. They saw the possibilities in Jim Clark's silicon chip. Not all engineers were so adventuresome as Clark. Probably some of them wanted to linger back east and be given multiple-choice personality tests until they retired to Sarasota or St. Petersburg. But a lot of the smart ones were looking for the chance to show just what they could do. Greg Chesson, a young engineer at Bell Labs, recalls visiting Clark's Stanford lab in 1981 and seeing the geometry engine in action. He watched a computer-generated image of Snoopy flying his doghouse across Clark's computer screen, a sight that just a few years later would seem unremarkable. In 1981, it was a kind of miracle. Chesson knew instantly he was looking into the future. "There was no question in my mind," he says. "I just said, 'All right, here is where I work now.'" Before long, Jim Clark's new company exerted a gravitational force on the technical mind. When you ask people who dealt with Silicon Graphics, or who worked for Silicon Graphics, or who bought machines from Silicon Graphics, or who simply observed Silicon Graphics from afar, they all say the same thing about it. "It was the smartest group of engineers I've ever seen in one place." Tom Jermalak recalls his first encounter with the company. This was 10 years before Jermalak became, at Jim Clark's behest, the CEO of At Home Networks. In 1985, Jermalak was an impressionable 31-year-old engineer at Hewlett-Packard. Someone at Silicon Graphics called him up and said he should come over, just to have a look around. He met Clark. Within minutes, they were off on an argument about the potential for computer-generated images. It lasted the afternoon.
"I just joined literally on the spot. Okay, I'm in," says Jermalak. "Jim was building the coolest stuff. You wanted to be around just to see what was going to happen next."
What was going to happen next, just about everyone thought, was that Silicon Graphics would become a big company. And it did. Clark had invented the technology, bet his career on it, and he'd been right. He had attracted the most talented engineers in Silicon Valley to his company, and they in turn created the most talented computers. But as a group, Clark began to complain, they had precious little to show for it. The lion's share of the equity and the power had been taken by others. Financiers and managers owned huge chunks of Silicon Graphics and had seized control of the board of directors, while Clark's engineers owned tiny slivers and watched the decision-making from afar. Sure, they were doing much better for themselves than they would have done back east, but they did not do as well as people who had had no hand in creating the technology. It didn't take long for Clark to become deeply irritated by the rules of American capitalism. In his opinion, the game was rigged so that the people who really mattered got the shaft.
He believed in his bones that the people who mattered most were the brilliant engineers, the chefs who cooked up the new recipes. Clark was a new growth theorist long before anyone in Silicon Valley heard of new growth theory. This opinion was hardly surprising. He was one of them. What he did with his opinion, however, was astonishing. He forced it down Silicon Valley's throat. He left it to the Valley to take care of the rest of the world. Of course, if the creator of the concept and the engineers who executed the concept were not getting what they deserved, someone else was getting more than he deserved. The first person Clark fingered was the man who lent him the money to build his new machine. When he set about to create his first company, Clark had no experience of the venture capitalists who back new enterprises. He wound up selling a 40% stake in Silicon Graphics to a man named Glenn Mueller at the prestigious Mayfield Fund for $800,000. Initially, Clark kept a 15% stake for himself, which implied that he, his invention, and his ability to attract engineers was worth $300,000. He liked the deal when he made it. It took him about 6 months to change his mind. His original stake in his own business soon became a lot smaller, and he became irritated. His backers were about to discover what that meant. Building new hardware costs a lot of money, much more than Clark realized. He and his engineers ran through their initial $800,000 of venture capital in less than a year and were forced to return to the venture capitalists hat in hand. Mueller and others put up another $17 million in exchange for another piece of the company. By the end of 1984, Clark's engineers had run through the $17 million and needed even more money, and so had to sell even more of their stakes in the business. As a result, before they'd made their first dollar, Clark and his engineers were largely squeezed out of their own enterprise.
"I wouldn't be surprised if of all the hugely successful companies in Silicon Valley, Silicon Graphics made the fewest millionaires out of the engineers who founded it," says Greg Chesson.
The Mayfield Fund ended up making about $400 million on its investment. Clark took this and almost everything else that happened at Silicon Graphics personally. At each step of the way, it became clearer that SGI would be a huge success, yet at each step of the way, Clark found himself more at the mercy of his financiers, who had nothing at risk but their money. 6 months after Silicon Graphics received its first infusion of capital, Clark decided somehow that he had sold too cheap. Glenn Mueller had cut a sweet deal for himself. Mueller was supposed to be a nice guy, everyone said so. The Mueller family threw the Christmas party each year that most everyone who was anyone in Silicon Valley wanted to attend. Clark had trusted him. He'd never do that again with a venture capitalist. And he never forgave Mueller for exploiting his ignorance. At board meetings and dinner tables, Mueller found himself subjected to Clark's fury.
"Jim's face would get red and he'd start shouting that Glenn had cheated him and his engineers," recalls Dick Kramlich, a Silicon Valley venture capitalist who joined the board of Silicon Graphics in 1984. "Glenn would just sit there and take it."
Actually, the venture capitalists were just the first item on Clark's list of what needed fixing in American capitalism. One day in late 1984, just as Silicon Graphics was preparing to ship its first machines, Glenn Mueller called a meeting in his office. It had taken 2 years from the founding of the company to its first product. The new computers were not easy to sell, at least not at first. SGI delivered far more computer than most people could handle. A cheap one cost $70,000. Founding engineer Mark Grossman recalled,
"Endless meetings and debates about how to squeeze what we had into a smaller box. Basically, we couldn't figure out how to make it cheap."
But even a cheap one was complicated to use, even for someone who knew his way around a computer. People with modest programming skills in front of a Silicon Graphics workstation sometimes felt a bit like a man in a Lamborghini on a two-lane road. The result was a struggle between the engineers who built ever niftier computers and the managers who had been brought in to market them. The managers wanted the engineers to make their product simpler to use. The engineers, like their leader, thought their managers were all idiots.
"They were promising stuff we couldn't deliver," said engineer Tom Davis, "and they didn't understand what we had. Of course, 15 more years of experience showed me that this is the normal situation."
At the time, however, the engineers were outraged. The managers would tell them to do one thing. The engineers would do the opposite, and no matter how it turned out, the engineers thought they were right until someone proved them wrong.
"It was like an especially contentious academic community," recalled Tom Jermalak. "You were encouraged to shred each other's stuff, and everyone had an opinion about everything."
Glenn Mueller's meeting was an attempt to sort out the problem and transform Jim Clark's company into a stable, well-adjusted, lasting institution. At the meeting were Clark, Vern Anderson, the CEO Mueller had told Clark he needed to have for the Mayfield Fund to supply him venture capital, a few other senior executives, and the venture capitalists bankrolling the enterprise. Dick Kramlich of New Enterprise Associates was the newest of these. It was Kramlich's first encounter with Clark's corporate culture, and it was the most contentious he'd ever seen. "People were yelling and screaming at each other over the most petty things, not even business things," he recalls. "I waited until it was 5 o'clock, and then I got out. I told them that I really didn't want to go through any more of this and to call me when they'd worked out their emotional problems." After the meeting, Vern Anderson stepped down as CEO. This should have surprised no one. After Mueller had told him that to obtain venture capital he needed a CEO, Clark had literally walked outside, found Vern Anderson on the street in Palo Alto, and asked him if he wanted the job. "I bargained for a temperamental handful," says Anderson. Clark never had any serious ambition to manage the company himself. Even then, he knew he'd be poorly suited for the job. He couldn't stand the small steps, the details, the tedium. He thought they should bring in some person to handle the details while he made sure that his beloved engineers kept on building the machine of the future. He didn't fully appreciate just how much power he had to relinquish for the detail person to do his job well. Soon enough, he found out. Mueller found another man to run the company. His name was Ed McCracken, a highly regarded vice president at Hewlett-Packard. When Mueller told Clark about McCracken and explained that Clark would have to give up the illusion that he still controlled Silicon Graphics, Clark broke down and cried.
"Jim always had a sense that we weren't doing things right," said Anderson. "He knew in his heart that we needed someone like Ed."
With the understanding that he would enjoy complete control, Ed McCracken left his safe, comfortable job at Hewlett-Packard and took a risky one at Silicon Graphics. He and Clark, taken together, were proof of the limits of physiognomy. To look at them, they could have been brothers, tall and blonde, with wire-rimmed spectacles perched on surprisingly delicate features. To watch them in action, you would think they came from different planets. Hewlett-Packard was the closest thing in the Valley to an enormous gray corporation, and Ed McCracken was the Valley's version of the organization man. He had mastered the unnaturally sincere tone of voice of the professional man. When he wished to indicate seriousness, he dropped his chin down into his throat. When he took you aside to have a word, he looked and sounded as if he was giving a speech to an audience of 1,000 people. To stress his points, which were rarely pointed or stressful, he'd press his thumb against his index finger as if he had just caught a fly by its wing. He wore suits. He hated strife. He loved consensus, or at any rate, the idea of it. For many of the founding engineers, it was their first experience with a serious American executive, and with the vaguely phony emotional postures that seemed to be, for whatever reason, necessary for the success of the leader of a large organization.
"He came off as being awkward and manipulative," said Mark Grossman. "There was no idle chit-chat."
"He had a weird way of using silence in conversation," said Kurt Akeley.
"Ed was one of those people who likes to design questionnaires for others to fill out," a third engineer said. McCracken liked to deal with people indirectly through intermediaries. As yet another of the engineers who left Stanford with Clark to found Silicon Graphics put it, "Ed had this phrase for all our problems. He said we were highly oppositional." It was that phrase, highly oppositional, that stuck in people's minds. In late 1984, McCracken took over the company from Clark, who stayed on as chairman, whatever that meant. He looked at the books and discovered that the company had only $7 million left and was running through money at the rate of $2 million a month, which meant it had exactly 3.5 more months to run. He had one long look at the contentious engineers and their warring opinions. He decided that Jim Clark's corporate culture needed more than a chief executive officer. It needed a therapist. McCracken hired a corporate psychologist. The psychologist, together with 40 Silicon Graphics employees, including the senior engineers and their leader Jim Clark, retreated for 3 days to a resort not far outside of the valley. There they submitted to a battery of psychological tests designed to make them better organization men. Before the retreat, Clark and his engineers were required to find 2 people to fill out psychological evaluations on their behalf and mail them to the corporate psychologist confidentially. Once they'd gathered together at the resort, the engineers filled out 2 more forms. The first was designed to classify them into 1 of 4 psychological types. These types probably said more about psychology as filtered through the American business mind than it did about the engineers. At any rate, the tests broke the world down into introverts and extroverts, then into right-brain versions and left-brain versions. The four types were given the following names. Introvert plus right-brained equals supportive. Introvert plus left-brained equals analytical. Extrovert plus right-brained equals promoter. Extrovert plus left-brained equals controller. Depending on the degree to which you possess these qualities, you were classified as a strong or weak version of your type. Ed McCracken was a weak analytical. Jim Clark was a strong controller. As Clark recalls it, "The psychologist determined that everyone else on the executive committee was passive-aggressive, and I was just aggressive." The engineers Clark had hired all scored pretty much the same as he did. Of the 30 engineers who took the test, only two registered as supportives, and two more were analyticals. The rest were controllers. The second test required Clark's engineers to answer 250 questions designed to further parse their psyches. The results were laid out on a pie chart with 12 slices. Again, each slice of pie represented a different personality type. The psychologist had odd little names for these, too. Humanistic, optimistic, vague, and so on. When the chart was completely filled in, 11 of the categories remained empty. The names of all the engineers were crammed into a single sliver of pie. Highly oppositional, it was labeled, which is when it occurred to the engineers where their new CEO got his lingo. Afterwards, each engineer was required to explain his psychological profile. That is where tempers finally flared. The charge that they were highly oppositional actually pleased a lot of Clark's engineers. To this day, it pleases them. For instance, Tom Davis, one of the 7 founding engineers who had followed Clark out of Stanford, says, "Their definition of oppositional was basically someone who stuck to his guns. That's clearly a bad trait if you stick to your guns when you're clearly wrong, but at the time, it was probably the best group of engineers I'd ever seen assembled, and everyone knew that they were almost always right. From my point of view, they had exactly the right qualities to produce great products. They were almost always right, and if you disagreed, you had a big argument to change their minds. But if you were right, after some struggle, they almost always would. If somebody insists that 2 + 2 = 5, I'll never back down, no matter how bad it makes them feel. I think that the shrink thought that you should. In non-engineering areas where things are a lot fuzzier, giving in more often is clearly a reasonable thing to do." The psychologist ran the subsequent 3-day-long drill like an AA meeting. He asked each of Clark's engineers to stand up, explain how he scored on his test, and tell everyone else how he planned to change. The second test, which the shrink kept calling the instrument, had reduced each engineer's personality to a 3-dimensional shape, which turned out to be a piece of paper with warts and divots and ridges. One of the company's founders grabbed his shape and let off. He rose and said that he had spent his whole life getting himself to the point where he could tell someone he was an idiot, and he had no intention of changing that now. Did anyone want to fight about it? The other engineers cheered. Another engineer said that he had figured out how the questions related to the profile, and he wanted to take the test again so he could get a perfect score. The shrink insisted that there was no such thing as a perfect score. "He went on and on and on, how there was no right answer," says Rocky Rhodes. "How this was just for us to get to know each other better. That there were no bad people and no bad shapes, that there was nothing judgmental about it. It was just a shape. You sat in front of the group on a little chair and held up your shape, one by one. Then Greg Chesson walks up and the shrink almost gasps. He says, 'Wow, that's perfect.'" One way of viewing Silicon Graphics in the mid-1980s is as an answer to a pair of questions. The first question was, if an extraordinarily willful human being with great technical aptitude is permitted to create a large business organization, how will that organization behave? By 1984, everyone understood that it would behave like Jim Clark, which is to say that it would behave as no big, successful American company had ever behaved. It would be a loose collection of argumentative, brilliant, bull-headed engineers who might or might not make money, but almost certainly would build something wonderful. The second question was, how would such a place ever grow old? The answer was, painfully. After the retreat, Ed McCracken quickly set about making his company less like Jim Clark. This is just how it always went with one of these new Silicon Valley hardware companies. Once it showed promise, it ditched its visionary founder, who everyone deep down thought was a psycho anyway, and became a sane, ordinary place.
With the support of Glenn Mueller and the other venture capitalists on the board of directors, McCracken brought in layer upon layer of people more like him, indirect, managerial, diplomatic, politically minded. These people could never build the machines of the future, but they could sell the machines of the present. And they did this very well. For the next 6 years, Silicon Graphics was perhaps the most successful company in Silicon Valley. The stock rose from $3 a share to more than $30 a share. The company grew from 200 employees to more than 6,000. The annual revenue swelled from a few million to billions. Therapy aside, the company remained the most desirable place to work if you were a certain kind of computer cowboy who wanted to live on the edge of the technology. The technology Clark and his brilliant engineers had invented turned out to be just what the world hungered for. At the same time, McCracken dealt Clark out of his own business. From McCracken's point of view, Clark was just wildly disruptive. He'd wander around the company stirring up all manner of trouble and cause all the engineers to become even more highly oppositional than they were on their own. Senior engineers turned up in his office and told him that the chairman, Clark, had persuaded them they'd be better off quitting Silicon Graphics and starting their own businesses, and McCracken would have to spend hours talking them into staying. But he found outlets for his own frustration. When McCracken joined the company in 1985, Glenn Mueller had assured both him and Clark that they would be paid the same amounts each year. In late 1989, McCracken called Mueller, who now chaired the Executive Compensation Committee, to complain about this rule. Mueller phoned the other members of the committee and changed the policy. The next year, McCracken was paid hundreds of thousands of dollars more than Clark. Not long after that, Clark ceased to be granted stock options in his company. He was the only member of the executive committee so treated. Given what happened later, it is easy to feel sorry for Ed McCracken. At the time, it was harder. Having established himself as the captain of the ship, he was doing what captains of industry have done since they were invented. He was transforming himself into an important person. He chaired conferences on the future of American industry. He hobnobbed with U.S. senators and testified before Congress. He encouraged the 1992 Clinton campaign to use Silicon Graphics as a backdrop for an important speech by Clinton on economic policy, only to find, too late, that Clark had decorated the halls that Clinton strode along with the cover of Fortune magazine that featured him. Once Clinton was elected president, McCracken became a regular at White House dinners. Such highfalutin behavior might not sit well with Clark's engineers, who accused him of not paying attention to the business, but it had a purpose. It created an air of permanence not merely about Ed McCracken, but also about Silicon Graphics. McCracken was trying to build something enduring. Order and hierarchy were essential to this process. McCracken was uncomfortable with even the most trivial challenges to his authority, which is to say that he lived in a state of perpetual discomfort. The engineers, inspired by Clark, were constantly challenging his authority. The practical jokes were a case in point. An engineer's idea of a joke is a practical joke, perhaps because a practical joke, unlike the less practical kind, needs to be designed. It requires the jokester to build the contraption to ensnare his victim. Silicon Graphics engineers loved their practical jokes, and they loved their chairman for the practical jokes he played, especially the ones he played on the boss. For instance, Clark had been struck by the inability of his teenage daughter to recall McCracken's name. She kept calling him Ed McMuffin. So one day, Clark brought one of the thin name plaques that were affixed to the doors in the executive suite, stenciled with the name Ed McMuffin. He replaced McCracken's name plaque and waited for the response. For 3 days, the new CEO walked in and out of an office with a door marked Ed McMuffin. The engineers would sneak up from their labs to watch him do it, then run back, giggling, to their work. Everyone waited for the glorious moment when the victim of an engineer's practical joke realized what was happening, and blushed and smiled and stammered, and told everyone what a good joke it had been. It never came. On the fourth morning of the joke, the engineers came to work, and the plaque with Ed McMuffin on it was gone. McCracken never said a word about it. Along with a lot of other pranks Clark played on McCracken, it festered in company lore. One day, years later, at a meeting filled with Clark's engineers and McCracken's managers, Clark told the story of how for 3 whole days, McCracken was McMuffin. McCracken reddened. The managers swallowed their laughter. "It was like someone had played a joke on the dictator and you weren't allowed to laugh," said one of the engineers who was there. Ed McCracken was Jim Clark's first intimate encounter with the American professional management class and its politics. From it was born his conviction that there was a whole layer of people in American business who called themselves managers, who were, in fact, designed to screw up his plans. Life was unfair. Jim Clark wasn't the first person ever to feel that way. More surprising was that a man who grew up, as he put it, sitting in a large pile of shit, would be as convinced as Clark was that life should be fair. He was so convinced of this that he set out to correct the problem and to take what rightfully belonged to him and to his engineers. Of course, it took people a while to realize that the new rule in Silicon Valley was that Jim Clark always got his way. It took 10 years to be exact. Right through the golden years of Silicon Graphics, as McCracken took over the company and made it his own, Clark fought a civil war. He persuaded his fellow engineers that they should feel as mistreated as he did.
"Tom," Davis, another founding engineer, "and I would go in and talk to Jim," recalled Rocky Rhodes, who had left Stanford with Clark to create SGI. "And we'd learn how shitty life was. When we'd leave his office, we'd say, 'Yeah, I guess we really have been mistreated. I guess we should have been paid millions of more dollars.' Before that, I had no idea. I walked into Silicon Valley with $500 a month from the government. I was a 27-year-old with essentially no computer experience. Now I had stock options that Jim said would one day be worth $1 million. Plus, I now had a big salary. Before I learned from Jim that I'd been mistreated, I was quite pleased."
A whispering campaign wasn't Clark's style. Anything he said to his engineers, he also said directly to McCracken. Dick Kramlich recalls a meeting between Clark and McCracken, attended by himself and Glenn Mueller.
"Jim just ripped Ed apart. He explained to Ed everything that was wrong with his character. Jim can be truly brutal, unfairly so. And that day he just took Ed apart into pieces. By the time he was finished, Ed was crying. No one knew what to say."
Clark's friends who did not know McCracken came to believe the man's name was Fucking Ed McCracken.
"Fucking Ed McCracken," Clark would say. "He may have helped to stabilize the company, but now he's destroying it. He can't see what's happening."
What was happening was the personal computer. When Clark created Silicon Graphics, the computer world was a pyramid. At the top were people like him and his engineers, who played with the fastest machines. At the bottom was the personal computer. The PC had been created in Silicon Valley as a toy for hobbyists, a joke technology derided by the sort of hotshot who worked for Jim Clark. Now it had found a market for its services. Moore's Law, which stated that the price of computing power would fall by half each 18 months, implied that the pyramid must collapse. The PC would soon be able to perform all the functions of a Silicon Graphics workstation. Microsoft controlled the market for personal computers through its operating system, and so Microsoft would displace Silicon Graphics. Microsoft and Silicon Graphics sold shares in themselves to the public the same year, 1986. Silicon Graphics might have been stunningly successful, but Microsoft was taking over the world.
"You could see a time when the PC would be able to do the sort of graphics that SGI machines did," said Clark. "And SGI would be toast. Eventually, Microsoft would take over its business."
The falling price of computing power was leading the computer into new markets. Moore's Law came with a social corollary. High-tech could not remain high-tech for long. You might be the smartest engineer in the valley, and you might have built the most sophisticated computer, but it was only a matter of time before some schlep with a PC wrote a program that let him do everything you could do at a fraction of the cost. Technical vanity did not pay. If you wanted to make a great deal of money and acquire a great deal of power, you cultivated a more egalitarian outlook. In the late 1980s and early 1990s, people with a reputation for inventing the future spent a lot of time talking about where the trend might lead next. Jim Clark was one of these people. In December 1990, he joined a discussion at a conference called PC Outlook. One of the questions the panel considered was, will personal computing and personal communications be combined, or will it just remain as science fiction? In 1990, the idea that people would use their PCs to communicate with one another was outlandish, yet it was still worth discussing. For if the computer ever did become a communications device, it might transform not just the valley, but the economy. It would plug the masses into the thinking machine, and the thinking machine into the masses. At the conference, Clark predicted that this would happen once the computer became fun to use. For the previous 2 years, he had argued that the new thing was computer games like Nintendo. He was wrong, but in an interesting way. He was groping towards a mass market. "Jim always was looking to democratize the technology," says Dick Kramlich.
He was always thinking about how to make some high-end technology accessible to a larger audience. That's what he'd done with the geometry engine. His chip cut the cost of real-time computer graphics from millions of dollars to tens of thousands. To Clark, there was only one solution. Silicon Graphics had to build a cheap computer to compete with the personal computer. Cheap machines meant mass markets, and mass markets meant great sums of money. In early 1987, he started arguing in characteristically undiplomatic fashion that SGI was doomed.
"Jim was probably 2 or 3 years ahead of the rest of us in seeing what was coming," Ed McCracken says. "He could see problems down the road, and the problems became emotionally important to him."
"I was saying, goddamn, we're out of our minds," says Clark. "I was so worried about the PC. I was adamant that we had to build a low-end product and that it had to be something that sold for under $5,000.
It didn't happen, largely because McCracken did not share Clark's view. Fred Kittler, then an analyst with J.P. Morgan, recalls visiting Clark in his office at SGI in early 1990.
"I was out here with a couple of analysts, and he was pacing back and forth like a man in a prison cell, complaining about how his board wouldn't let him create his cheap computer. It was clear by then he had no real power."
Clark thought that Silicon Graphics had to cannibalize itself. For a technology company to succeed, he argued, it needed to always be looking to destroy itself. If it didn't, someone else would.
"It's the hardest thing in business to do," he would say. "Even creating a lower-cost product runs against the grain because the low-cost products undercut the high-cost, more profitable products."
Everyone in a successful company, from the CEO on down, has a stake in whatever the company is currently selling. It does not naturally occur to them to find a way to undermine that product. Clark thought he knew how to become the agent of his own creative destruction, and he was prepared to do the deed. He wanted Silicon Graphics to operate in the same self-corrosive spirit. More to the point, he wanted Ed McCracken to operate in this way, but Ed McCracken was not the man to roll the bones on the future, for which he could hardly be faulted, since as CEO he would get a lot more of the blame for any gamble that went wrong. Still, he manufactured a contradiction in the heart of his company. All the good things that happened at Silicon Graphics happened because Clark had guessed that computer graphics had a commercial future. The company had been built entirely on Jim Clark's foresight, but once it became a big company, it had no room inside it for Clark or his hunches. A big company, even a big company as highly charged as SGI, needs to believe its own internal propaganda, that its products are the best, that its technology will win, etc. It has trouble entertaining the thought that it is doomed. When it became clear to Clark that he could not force his own company to reinvent itself and lead this charge, he went into another dark hole of despair. He just married for the third time, and his new wife, the journalist Nancy Rutter, had started to complain about his behavior. He had to find something else to occupy his turbulent mind. He hired people to renovate his house. He bought a motorcycle and rode it too fast. He discovered model helicopters. At first, he was embarrassed someone would see him. It was such a typical techno-geek thing to do. But they had these fantastically elaborate kits that let you assemble a machine that you could fly by remote control. So he would wait until the middle of weekdays when the neighbors were all at work. Then he'd take out his helicopter kit and fly. Soon enough, Clark had become obsessed with his little choppers. He'd put them together in the garage, then take them out and fly them around the neighborhood. He'd buzz other people's homes. Nancy would come out to the garage and see this 6-foot-3-inch-tall, 47-year-old man bent over the ground, piecing together a toy designed for a small boy. At least in the beginning, they resembled children's toys. Clark started with the small models. Once he got the hang of it, he moved on to the bigger, more realistic machines. The bigger machines kicked up huge clouds of dust in the front yard, so naturally he built a landing pad in his driveway. He'd stand out there for hours in the middle of the day, in the middle of the week, executing takeoffs and landings of these giant toy helicopters. One day, some workers he'd brought over to move a swimming pool or build a hill made the mistake of parking their cars near his landing pad. Clark went over to them and told them, in a slightly embarrassed tone, that they might want to move the cars as he planned to fly his helicopters. The workers laughed and went about their business. Clark seized the controls of his largest helicopter and sent it up, up, up over the neighborhood. And then something went terribly wrong. As he guided it down towards the landing pad, the controls ceased to function, and instead of gliding backwards and down, the helicopter came zooming straight for his head. Clark dropped the remote control and dived out of the way just in time. The helicopter whipped along the side of the workers' cars with a horrible whack, 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 as it dented the doors and peeled the paint. Obviously, he couldn't spend all of his time flying toy helicopters around his neighborhood. He wrote the workers a check for the $2,000 to cover the damages and took up computer programming. Chapter 5. Inventing Jim Clark. When I asked Kitu Kalari what he thought of his first encounter with Jim Clark, he thought for a moment and then said,
"So."
This was not unusual. When a computer programmer answers a question, he often begins with the word "so." "Why did you come to Silicon Valley?" "So, I'm from this small town in Iowa." "So" cuts across the borders within the computing class, just as "like" cuts across the borders within the class of adolescent girls. It's the most distinctive verbal tic manufactured by the engineering mind. Silicon Valley engineers, for whom English is a second or even third language, acquire it as readily as native speakers. Nobody knows why. Some say that "so" imposes the semblance of logic on an essentially illogical event, human conversation. After all, "so" implies that the answer follows directly from the question. Others claim that "so" just buys you time to think.
"So," said Kitu Kalari,
who learned to speak English where he learned to program computers, in Hyderabad, India.
"Jim Clark walks into our office at Silicon Graphics. It is 1990. I have just joined the company. And I'm thinking, this could not be. The chairman of SGI has just walked into our office. He walked right by my cube. He's standing right there next to Pavan."
Pavan is Pavan Nigam, the Indian man who hired Kitu to work at Silicon Graphics.
"Jim Clark didn't say anything. He was looking at our group. Finally, he turns to Pavan and says, 'Pavan, we got to get some more Indians around here.' I was so shocked. I am thinking, you cannot say such a thing in California. It must be against the law."
Clark then asked to see what the Indian engineers were working on. Pavan and Kitu showed him. Silicon Graphics was still having problems making its machines easy for people to use. Clark could relate. Looking for some way to occupy himself, he had taken to programming at home on a Silicon Graphics workstation. He was experiencing some of the same frustrations as SGI's customers, and was hungry for anything that made it easier for him to write programs that worked. And that, it turned out, was why he had paid his call on Pavan and Kitu. Clark was a physicist by training. When he returned to programming computers again, he wrote his code in the language of physics, mathematics. The Silicon Graphics machine required the programmer to translate his math into computer language. For example, if you wished to square a number in a program, you needed to write it as X star star 2.
"Jim was speaking German, and the machine only knew Spanish," said Pavan Nigam. "So there was this extra layer of thought required to turn Jim's German into Spanish. This drove Jim crazy. He thought the machine should bloody well know German, since German was the language of first principles. Since he was the chairman, we would say, 'Good idea, Jim, good idea, Jim.' And then we would talk to product development people, and they would say, 'Why the hell do you want to do that? That is about number 300 on a list of 300 things we need to do right now.'"
Clark turned the young Indians into his private software tutors. The young Indians were both flattered and impressed. 2 minutes with Clark, and the young wizards always fell under his spell, as many engineers before them had done. They felt that Jim Clark understood their value as no other important person did.
"Jim Clark is not one of these flakes who starts companies," said Kitu. "He's not some manager who doesn't know what he's talking about. When he first saw the tools, he knew exactly what they meant. He knew we were onto something."
But it was a few months before Kitu discovered why Clark had taken up computer programming, which seemed a rather odd activity for such an important man. Then one day, Kitu's phone rang. He picked it up, and a female voice on the other end of the line told him that Jim Clark was calling. Kitu felt a surge of excitement. He pictured Clark sitting at his fine desk in his fine office in the finest of the dozen red brick buildings on the Silicon Graphics campus. There was a long pause, and then Clark's voice, distant and crackling. He sounded as if he was in Outer Mongolia.
"Kitu,"
Clark said,
"I have this bug I can't find."
He described the problem he was having. Kitu could barely hear him. He sounded so distant.
"Jim," he asked, "where the hell are you?"
Long pause. More crackling on the line. Then Clark's deep voice.
"I'm not sure."
"What do you mean you're not sure?"
asked Kitu. Nervous laughter.
"Off the coast of New Zealand somewhere."
"Jim, what are you doing off the coast of New Zealand?"
"I'm on my boat."
Clark had bought a second-hand sailboat. The boat came equipped with a personal computer which Clark had chucked over the side on principle. In its place, he'd installed a Silicon Graphics workstation.
Jim, what are you doing programming a goddamn computer off the coast of New Zealand?
More nervous laughter.
I'm programming the boat.
And this was the first inkling that Kittu, and so also Pavan, had, that all was not right with Jim Clark. Soon Kittu figured out that Clark called him from everywhere except his fine office in his fine building at Silicon Graphics. The man had stopped showing up for work. He spent all of his time writing a navigation program for the sailboat he had just bought. He was doing this, he once told them, because he had ideas about the future of high technology that no one would listen to. Teaching his boat to sail itself diverted his mind from the fact that others, not him, were about to inherit the Earth. On his boat, he could think about how to inherit the Earth from its current heirs. For about 9 months, Clark called Kittu and Pavan regularly to pester them about his software. Then he went silent. About that time, late 1990, early 1991, the cardboard boxes in his guest room, stuffed by his devoted secretary with his old papers, suggested his life took another unexpected turn. Clark's motorcycle skidded out from under him as he rounded a bend near his home in Atherton. It crushed his leg against the street and laid him up in bed for 6 weeks. It gave him another reason to be angry with Ed McCracken. If McCracken would do what Clark told him to do, he, Clark, wouldn't be forced to amuse himself by riding around on motorbikes on wet city streets in the middle of the week. In bed, waiting for his leg to heal and with nothing better to do but curse McCracken, he wrote a paper. It summarized his thinking of the past few years as he groped for a solution to what he viewed as Silicon Graphics's inevitable doom. He was right about the future of the company. Through its monopoly of the operating system, Microsoft already controlled the personal computer. Microsoft would one day overrun the high end of computing, where Silicon Graphics made its money. Microsoft had made it clear that the only way to preserve your station in Valley life was to create a monopoly. If you created a monopoly, you were at least partially exempt from the ordinary rapid cycle of creation and destruction. In computing, a monopoly took the form of a toll booth. Bill Gates had his toll booth, the PC operating system. Jim Clark wanted his own toll booth. In 1991, people who had computers on their desks used them mainly for financial analysis and word processing, but that was sure to change as the price of computer memory fell. But for the moment, the reach of the personal computer was nothing like that of the television set. About 95% of American households owned at least one television set. Only 1 in 10 owned a computer. To Jim Clark, this looked like a huge opportunity. Turn the television set into a computer. He finished his paper in bed and called it the telecomputer. Technically, the telecomputer was feasible. The United States had a tantalizing new infrastructure into which such a device might plug. In the previous decade, the cable television industry had laid pipes leading into 75% of American homes, and those pipes could carry information into and out of a telecomputer. The question was, could you make a telecomputer cheaply and persuade ordinary people to buy it? If so, you could control an exciting new chunk of the American economy. The computer had an important trait that the ordinary